coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Yes, it's important for this work to be financially affordable. And also, when you look around at the psychedelic community and field as it is now, you see that it's slowly changing. There's been a lot of effort that a number of people, folks at Shakruna and Monica Williams and amazing justice, equity, and inclusion team at MAPS who've really started to shift things in a good direction in the past, I would say, couple of years. But even so, the community is very white. We're working at Sage Institute, not just to make our services affordable, but also to start to offer education and outreach to communities of color around the work that we do and its safety and efficacy, and also to bring forward a team of therapists who reflect the identities of the people that we serve, to create a sense of safety for people when they're stepping into the work, to be able to feel like this therapist can understand me in a different kind of way. The last thing we do is we incorporate social justice and cultural responsivity into our training. So we hire a whole diverse range of therapists, and we support everyone in feeling really comfortable addressing cultural issues as they may come up in the treatment.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Equal access to psychedelic medicine is a huge issue in this burgeoning field. Today's guest, Genesee Hertzberg, has prioritized ethics in founding Sage Institute, a sliding scale clinic that offers psychotherapy and psychedelic assisted therapy. And she is also supporting the proliferation of ethical clinics through a new consulting group, Fourth Road Health. On the show, we discuss how Sage Institute uses the community mental health clinic model to provide greater access to psychedelic assisted therapy. We talk about Sage's protocols as well as its training and research components. We discuss the efficacy of different molecules for treatment, as well as the cytolytic versus psychedelic approach to ketamine-assisted therapy. Finally, we discuss Fourth Road, a forthcoming strategic consulting company that supports academic, medical institutions, healthcare systems, independent practitioners, and therapy providers exploring psychedelic-assisted therapy. Genesee is an individual, couple, and family therapist. She trained in MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD with MAPS and ketamine-assisted therapy with the Kyra Institute. She is the co-founder and executive director of both Sage Integrative Health and Sage Institute, both located in California in the Bay Area. And finally, this podcast is brought to you by Maya, a software platform designed to help psychedelic practitioners manage, measure, and illustrate health outcomes. We are currently working with ketamine practitioners, including today's guest, in the development of the platform through our Council of Guides, of which Genesee is a member. If you're interested in being part of this group, helping to co-create the Maya platform, please visit bit.ly/Maya Council. That's bit.ly/MAYACOUNCIL. And now, here's Genesee. Genesee, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you today.
Thanks, Eamon. I'm really happy to be here.
I've been a fan of Sage Institute for a while, and it's a really beautiful and really revolutionary model of affordable care in the psychedelic space. And so today on the show, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to facilitate you sharing some of what you've learned to help other clinicians and psychedelic therapists. So it's a really It's a great opportunity for our listeners and for myself.
Great. Yeah. It's a real passion of mine to support other clinics in coming into being in a good way.
So when did you first realize that psychedelics, which are often used in a recreational context, could be profound for healing not only individuals, but societies and communities?
I came across psychedelics in my late teens, early 20s. I was introduced to them by a dear friend who very shortly after we started connecting around the topic, actually, he ended up dying in a drunk driving accident. And that was a, you know, a huge, huge loss for me, threw me into a sort of existential crisis and made me question my whole life, what we were doing here. I was living in Spain at the time and really just at a loss for what to do with my life and how to make sense of things, given that you could lose someone so quickly like that, or we could, you know, just suddenly die. It really threw me for a loop. And I found myself turning to him and what he had brought me in his short life, and started to explore psychedelics and psilocybin in particular, and found that it helped me to connect to something greater than myself and find a sense of purpose there rather than in the day-to-day activities that I had been finding meaning in previously. And ultimately, over time, really helped to pull me out of a deep depression. And so I kind of stumbled across them and learned about their healing properties by mistake. But in coming out of that, I found myself really excited about the idea that these could help people, and thought that I had invented psychedelic assisted therapy, and then went and Googled it and found that people had been doing it for decades and then in fact centuries on some level. And so, you know, just kind of did what I could to plug myself into those communities.
And you actually have a doctorate in clinical psychology from CIIS, and you were awarded the Kransky Scholarship for research with MDMA-assisted therapy. So prior to starting SAGE, you were already winning scholarships in your work with psychedelics, which is a wonderful place to come from when you're jumping into providing this service for others.
Yeah, that's actually how I found my way to the California Institute of Integral Studies, is, you know, through this process of looking around to see, well, who's doing this? I saw that CIIS was both, you know, studying it in various ways with Stan Grof and in various others, and also that they offered a scholarship to support research and psychedelic work. And so that was what drew me to that school. And that's where I ended up getting my doctorate in clinical psychology and writing my dissertation.
What was the most interesting thing that you learned about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy at that time? Are there any little nuggets that we might not know about the efficacy of MDMA in the work that you were doing?
There totally are, actually, though, you know, though that was just a dissertation, which is a big project, but it also, you know, the best advice that I got in writing my dissertation is a good dissertation is a done dissertation. So really just, you know, get it done. People may read it, but not necessarily a lot of them. You can always publish later and tidy it up. So it's not my proudest piece of work, but I did learn a lot through that process. You know, at the time I had a little bit of a starstruck attitude towards psychedelics, like, oh, these are amazing. They're going to help everyone. And they certainly do have so much potential to help people. But I thought that in interviewing people, I interviewed people who had gone through underground psychedelic therapy and thought I was going to get all of these rave reviews. And I did. I heard from many people how important it was in their healing and transformation. But I also heard from a couple of different people that they had had challenging experiences. And so really what it ended up teaching me was about the importance of a solid preparation for one, really good integration for two, and also the importance of a good therapeutic relationship. And that piece was, you know, we know about set and setting and we know about preparation and integration, but the most interesting case that I learned about was of a woman who had been working with her therapist for about a year and had developed a good working relationship in many ways. But this therapist was about to leave the country. And the client had an experience as a child of being abandoned by her mother as a young child at like 5 or 7 years old. And the MDMA session that they planned was about a year into the treatment. And then it was only about, I would say, a month to 6 weeks before the therapist planned to move out of the country. And they didn't talk about the fact that the treatment was going to be ending suddenly and ending right before going into doing deep work together that typically brings the therapist and client closer together. And instead, it was a bit of a reenactment of her early loss that never got talked about. So the MDMA session itself was that the client found herself kind of off in the corner of a room playing with scarves and really distracting herself, is how she described it later, staying in sort of a superficial space where she never really dropped in. And then afterwards, again, they never talked about that this sense of abandonment that was coming up for her. And the client was more depressed for 2 years after the session. So it showed me that when careful attention to the relationship itself, especially in longer term treatment, isn't tended to, that the therapy can actually be harmful rather than helpful.
And I can see how that may have influenced some of the focus on training that happens at Sage. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but I can imagine that particular experience has really influenced the way that Sage creates relationships within communities and seeks to train individuals within communities to better support folks from those communities, which is something that I really admire about Sage.
It's influenced my entire thinking about both, yeah, how we hold the work at Sage Institute and also our sister organization, Sage Integrative Health, and also how I'm, you know, trying to support the rollout of clinics and delivery systems as a whole.
I'm curious about how your awareness first ignited and then grew around the issue of accessibility to psychedelics. Without that attention to psychedelics actually properly being an accessible medicine for everyone, then all it's really doing is helping sort of advance the people who can afford it. And I'm curious, when you were first imagining a clinic, did you have that as a core value in mind to begin with, or is that something that evolved over time?
Yeah, that's been a core value from the beginning. It was Sage Integrative Health that was my first baby. And I first imagined into that clinic as being an integrative health center with psychedelic medicines that was accessible and affordable to everyone. And this came from, you know, my own trials and tribulations around getting the care that I needed, not so much psychedelic medicine, because that's just not integrated, wasn't integrated into the health system at the time at all, but even just, you know, regular medicine to treat, you know, some struggles that I was dealing with at the time, and running into the fact that Western medicine wasn't really helping me, that I was relying on more integrative modalities like acupuncture, massage, and nutrition, and that those things weren't covered by my insurance. Also just running into challenges with insurance coverage as a whole, and, you know, at the time not having a lot of financial resources, and so struggling to be able to pay for both insurance and the medical treatment that I needed. And it just left me in a real sense of frustration with our broken healthcare system and how fragmented it is, and really wanting to create something different. And so, yeah, from the beginning, the hope was to create something that was both integrative and also affordable.
And so you first started with integrative health, and then you created the Sage Institute as a separate organization. Can you explain the difference between these two organizations?
Yeah. A lot of people ask. And so I started off with Sage Integrative Health. The hope was to be able to make our services fully accessible there. And it was just challenging to figure out how to do that from within the business model that we had. It's hard to collect donations as a for-profit, and we're not a for-profit trying to maximize profit at all. That just was the business structure that made the most sense for us at the time. Yeah, like I said, it's hard to bring in donations. There also isn't insurance coverage for psychedelic medicines or most integrative health services still. And we want to be able to pay our practitioners a decent living, what they deserve. And so ultimately, in thinking about, you know, how to make this work, it made sense to have a nonprofit entity to house the more affordable services. So along with a group of colleagues, so we together started envisioning into what a clinic that could bring the fees way, way, way down. And that ended up looking like a nonprofit organization, and also an internship training center. So we have interns who are still gaining their hours towards licensure who come and work for us, and they receive rigorous training in depth-oriented, trauma-informed psychedelic medicine in exchange for offering lower fee services.
That reminds me of how I first approached acupuncture, was in a clinic similar to that in Oakland, actually. And at that time, I didn't have very much money. And so that was the best way that I could do it. And I ended up having a relationship with an acupuncturist who I then ended up working with in private practice for 10 years afterwards. So it's a great model.
It tends to work really well for folks. And often, yeah, we hire amazing therapists. And so though it definitely, over time, you develop your skills in psychotherapy, they're supervised by licensed providers and experts in the field. And so the work is held really well, and people are able to develop long-term relationships with their therapists. It's a 2-year training model, and then they can go on and take their clients with them into private practice.
And so with the sliding scale community mental health clinic model, is then that supported and additionally by donations? How does the business model actually work?
Yeah, so we're able at this point to bring in about half of our revenue through our sliding scale client fees, and then the other half through donations and grants from the community. And at this point, that's an essential part of our business model. Over time, we would like to increase our self-sustainability, and we're looking at doing that through broadening our training programs.
Do the two organizations support each other in certain ways, financially or with clinicians between the two organizations?
We do have clinicians who work at both organizations. In particular, some of our founding members at Sage Institute also work as therapists at Sage Health. In terms of supporting each other financially, we actually need to be really careful about that legally. So we keep our businesses quite separate, our affairs quite separate.
That makes sense. I imagine that, though, that there's a lot of sharing of knowledge. And obviously, since you're involved in both, your ability to take the lessons from one and apply them to the other is probably really supportive to both practices.
Huge. Yeah. Yeah. We've been able to take a lot of our models, both our training models and also our clinical models, from Sage Health and transfer those over to Sage Institute. And then as we learn and refine them at both organizations, yeah, there's an open information exchange.
So with Sage Institute, the big piece that is often spoke about, Irina and I spoke about it on the podcast that we did, is about the accessibility piece. And accessibility isn't just about affordability. So of course, you know, having a sliding scale model is definitely a huge help for getting more people who can get this treatment. But there are a lot of other aspects to accessibility, including cultural accessibility, including people even knowing that these treatments are going to be helpful or supportive to them. So I'm curious about the other ways in which Sage supports accessibility and kind of promotes psychedelic medicine within different communities.
Yeah, that's such an important part of accessibility. It really, yes, it's important for this work to be financially affordable. And also, when you look around at the psychedelic community and field as it is now, you see that it's slowly changing. There's been a lot of effort that a number of people, folks at Shakruna and Monica Williams and amazing justice, equity, and inclusion team at MAPS who've really started to shift things in a good direction in the past, I would say, couple of years. But even so, it's the community is very white. And that has a number of reasons. I think, though, a big part of it has to do with the drug war and the ways in which communities of color were targeted by the drug war, leaving many people of color understandably hesitant to step into doing psychedelic work. We're working at Sage Institute not just to make our services affordable, but also to start to offer education and outreach to communities of color around the work that we do and its safety and efficacy, and also to bring forward a team of therapists who reflect the identities of the people that we serve, to create a sense of safety for people when they're stepping into the work, to be able to feel like this therapist can understand me in a different kind of way. The last thing we do is we incorporate social justice and cultural responsivity into our training. So we don't, you know, we hire a whole diverse range of therapists, and we support everyone in feeling really comfortable addressing cultural issues as they may come up in the treatment.
You mentioned outreach and education. What exactly does that look like? How are you interfacing with these different communities?
Yeah. So at this point, our outreach and education programs are still in development. And it's partially because we got such an onslaught of interest from, you know, from the time that we opened. And so from very diverse communities. And so it's actually been more subtle at this point. And there are two ways that it shows up. Some of it has to do with just education within the psychotherapy treatment. So helping people to learn about these medicines, about how they impact the psyche, to deconstruct narratives that the drug war put out there around drugs just being bad for your brain, driving you crazy, killing you, that kind of thing. Like that there's a lot of deconstruction that we're needing to do. And then the other pieces that we're putting together educational programs, so drop-in groups and information, sort of info sessions where people can learn about what we do and ask questions.
And another piece that you spoke about was the diversity amongst therapists, that being a key aspect to accessibility. And that kind of leans into the training component of Sage Institute. So I'm curious around what sort of interest you've had in folks coming to train, and what kind of backgrounds are the folks who are interning at Sage, where are they coming from, and perhaps even how someone who's listening to this podcast right now might be able to get involved and connect with you there.
Yeah. So we've had a decent amount of interest from therapists wanting to get their training at Sage. We do have our applications open right now for the next training cohort. So you can go to our website and go to the training page on our website, sageinst.org.
When does that close, that next cohort?
That's a good question. I think the applications, we're still accepting them for another month or two.
Okay. And maybe we can put that date in the show notes and I'll reach out to you afterwards about it.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. And we've been, you know, very happy to see that we have therapists with a whole range of different backgrounds and identities who are coming to join us. So our team of therapists currently is very diverse. It's about 50% people of color and another 40 to 50% who identify as queer.
So in addition to, we have the accessibility piece, we have the training piece, and then the third kind of pillar of Sage Institute is the research component. Are you currently conducting research at Sage, or is that something that's still in development at the moment?
It's definitely in development right now, though we are collecting outcome data. So we're tracking our clients who go through our ketamine program through several different baseline measures. It includes questionnaires looking at depression levels, anxiety, PTSD, and bipolar disorder. And so at this point, we're just taking in information. But the plan is, once we get enough of it, to look at how the work is impacting people. Right now, there's not enough information out there around ketamine work, particularly with people who have a history of trauma and have PTSD diagnoses. And most of our clients have some form of trauma in their background. And so we're hoping to contribute to the field in that way. And then we also are cooking up some ideas around different research projects. And these are all very early on, but we're excited about the idea of looking at group work in particular, and potentially group work with MDMA. There are various ways to bring MDMA and psilocybin into practices at this point before it's fully legal. One of them is to become an expanded access site, which Sage Integrative Health is planning to be. And another is to create an investigator-initiated trial ourselves, looking at, you know, researching one of those medicines in a new format. So we're, you know, kind of the thing we're tossing around right now, though it may be still another year or more in development, is MDMA-assisted group therapy to work with racial trauma and cultural trauma.
That's fascinating. In the group work, are you considering any kind of ceremony models or anything that's kind of drawing on indigenous traditions with psychedelic healing?
You know, we're again very early on in thinking about this. It's hard to go into group psychedelic experiences without drawing on some of the, you know, centuries of development that indigenous traditions have put into this work and have like contributed to this work. Meanwhile, you also want to draw on group therapy models. So kind of a mixture of tradition and more, you know, innovative models.
Now, you've done, investigated somewhat MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in the context of your research. Are you looking at different ways that these molecules might be used with different sorts of disorders or different issues that people are coming in with? Have you kind of looked at where you might be using ketamine versus MDMA versus psilocybin? Are you at that stage yet where you're kind of imagining that?
Starting to, yeah. There's a lot to think about there, but I love the question. It's a fun one to kind of geek out on. And I'm also right now a therapist in the MDMA for PTSD trials sponsored by MAPS. So I'm getting to see the way that MDMA is just a really effective medicine for trauma. In particular, ketamine, I see as also being a good support for working with trauma, but it doesn't have the same capacity that I see MDMA having to really get in there. It really depends on the person. Ketamine is such a mysterious and unique compound that impacts people in a huge variety of ways, where MDMA is super predictable. Like you're going to get a pretty similar experience out of, you know, any number of different people who work with that medicine. So I think for that reason too, it's just a safe fallback for people with trauma. People struggling with depression, on the other hand, especially more treatment-resistant severe depression, often benefit from ketamine, not just from the psychotherapeutic aspects, but also through a biochemical effect.
And that's the serotonin 2A receptor interaction? Is that the... Are you familiar with the chemical actions of ketamine? I'm not quite sure on it. So
I am. It's actually the receptor I'm not clear on, but I know that it impacts the NMDA receptor, and also it works with the glutamate system. So I want to say that the serotonin 2A receptor is more in effect with like LSD and psilocybin, but I could be wrong there.
Okay, well, that question came from me having no actual knowledge, just having heard the serotonin 2A receptor referenced a lot. So I appreciate you giving some clarity there, because that was a little bit off the cuff.
I think my understanding is that that's one that functions more in the classical psychedelics and is related to some of the hallucinogenic effects that psilocybin and LSD tends to have, where ketamine, it's centered a lot more in the glutamate system, which has an impact on many, many different systems in the brain, but in particular movement and memory and learning. Yeah.
And I think that a lot of clinicians are starting with ketamine assisted therapy because that's what's available now. But a lot of folks are really excited about MDMA and psilocybin. Do you have any suggestions for clinicians who are currently working with ketamine who may not have experience with these other molecules to begin to understand how to bring them into their practice when they become available?
I think that ketamine work really sets you up to step into these other forms of treatment. And the primary differences have to do with the length of the session, really. You're going from a 3-hour session with ketamine to an 8-hour session with MDMA or psilocybin. So it's a whole different ballgame on some level in terms of, you know, what's required to be in a session for that long and to stay in a session for that long. Really, a co-therapist becomes essential. I find, you know, having someone else there to help hold the space and to help, you know, make space for you to take breaks, that kind of thing. Other than that, the work is pretty similar. Yeah, it's also MDMA and psilocybin both have their differences. You know, MDMA tends to be more engaging with the clients on and off throughout the session, where psilocybin, you're going inwards for a, you know, somewhat extended period of time and then coming out and processing afterwards. It's actually kind of, there's a division in ketamine work between low dose sessions and high dose sessions, and the low dose sessions are more akin to MDMA work, and the high dose sessions are more akin to psilocybin work.
Oh, interesting. And do you use both of those approaches at Sage?
I do. Yeah. We call them the psycholytic approach and the psychedelic approach.
And why might you choose one approach versus another?
So the psycholytic approach, which is lower dose ketamine, it's useful and effective in doing more like psychotherapeutic work in the session. So it, for trauma in particular, it's helpful for people to stay a little bit more present in the room, to be able to work with the therapist around what comes up in the moment. Somatic work can be really useful in these cases, working with what comes up in the body. Touch work also can be really useful. And relational work, working in the relationship between therapist and client, it, you know, kind of loosens the defenses and opens up access to more unconscious material, or typically unconscious material. And so you just kind of have this space to explore regions that are typically a little harder to access. Higher dose sessions have the potential to be, you know, mystical spiritual experiences, which can be incredibly healing for people stuck in a depressive rut or who don't have much of a connection to a sense of meaning or connection to something bigger than themselves. And they also can be a open up space for people to start to explore their inner realms and also their connection with the outer realms on their own, and then come back and report back with the therapist and start to explore them. It's kind of like going into a dream world and then coming back and doing dream analysis, something like that.
So at Sage, when a client comes in to do this work, what is the protocol for the course of their treatment? So, you know, in addition to there's the psychedelic sessions themselves, but what's the kind of full protocol? Obviously, I mean, it would depend on the client certainly, but broadly, what can a client expect who comes in to Sage Institute?
So they will start off by doing an intake and filling out some baseline measures, like I mentioned, and then they'll sometimes they'll meet with the psychiatric prescriber first to do an intake and determine whether they're eligible for ketamine work. Those are people who are coming in primarily for ketamine-assisted therapy. Maybe they even have their own therapist, and so this is more of an adjunctive treatment. For others who are coming in to do both psychotherapy and ketamine in the context of their ongoing therapy, they may start with their therapist and meet for a few sessions. Right now, we're asking people who are doing this in the context of an ongoing treatment to meet with their therapist for a couple months, even maybe a few months, to really develop a relationship there, for us to, you know, get clear on whether ketamine is a good fit. And also, you know, with people who have more of a history of trauma, it's just important to create a very safe space for them, to help them to learn how to ground in their bodies, how to resource, how to take care of themselves, and also helping people to create really good structures in their life that can support the work. Because psychedelic therapy can, while it can be, you know, very powerful and ultimately healing, it can also open up a lot. Like I said, it brings unconscious material to the surface, and that can be destabilizing for people. And it, you know, often people feel, they notice, you know, repressed emotions or memories coming up even before you even go into the ketamine sessions, and certainly during and afterwards. And so people need to be prepared to, like, oh, I'm going to dive into an experience that on some level can feel unraveling, and I need really good support to do that. Ultimately, this is all for the sake of healing, and it helps people to work through that material, process it, get support from the therapist in integrating it, and then stabilizing over time. But we want people to know that it can be a rocky experience, and really feel well prepared for that. So people get a picture of what a whole ketamine treatment can look like, you know, after however long we decide the preparation needs to be. And that's a conversation between the therapist and client. People then step into the ketamine work itself. And that looks like sometimes a series of ketamine sessions that are spaced out by either weeks or even months sometimes, with plenty of time to integrate in between. And everyone's path is so different and individualized that it's hard to say there's one, you know, right way to do this. But sometimes it's a matter of months and with, you know, a ketamine session every other week, something like that. And then sometimes it's a, you know, treatment that goes on for a couple of years and there, or even, you know, longer if the therapist chooses to take the client with them. And ketamine sessions are kind of scattered throughout. They happen every few months or something like that. And they deepen and open the treatment as it goes. So that's the trajectory of the treatment itself.
So just before we zoom out to the landscape of psychedelic therapy broadly, I wonder if you have any choice bits of advice for someone who might be listening who would like to set up their own clinic and is really looking at Sage's model and is wanting to do like the community mental health clinic model, who's wanting to really have an ethical approach to affordable and accessible healthcare at the core of what they're doing. Are there any unexpected things that they might need to be aware of? Are there any little choice bits of advice you might have for someone who wants to do that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And, you know, this will maybe transition into the conversation that we're stepping into later around, you know, work that I'm doing to try to support clinics who are stepping into it, because a lot of people wanting to do this work are wanting to open clinics are also clinicians and don't necessarily have a background in business, don't necessarily have a background in operations. And so there's a lot that you're kind of needing to figure out and learn as you go. I think, you know, one piece of advice that I think I wish that I had heard early on is really try to get adequate funding from the start so that you can pay yourselves and you can pay others to help build it with you and others who have a diverse set of skills. So, you know, ideally someone who has experience in operations and in healthcare administration, you know, in these areas that we just don't learn about as clinicians to help balance things out and support the development early on, because there's just a high potential for burnout. You know, I've found myself exhausted and overworked and underpaid for a long time now. And really I think that there is substantial funding out there. It's just a matter of really taking the time to seek it out and connect with potential donors or investors to support the build out from the beginning. And I'm actually in contact with some people and also potentially working to help streamline funding sources to support clinics in doing that.
So what you've just referenced is, you know, the work that you're now stepping into about supporting the ethical build out of clinics. And that's through this organization, Fourth Road, which you are currently helping to co-found. This is the first I've heard of Fourth Road and preparing for this conversation. So I'd love to hear more about that project and the way that you're trying to impact the psychedelic landscape. And so maybe as a starting place to talk about it, the psychedelic medical industry landscape is moving very, very fast, and there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of big ideas to make a lot of money. So we're in this strange place where I think a lot of folks who have been in the existing psychedelic community for many years are like, okay, let's go slow, let's build this right. And then there's also a lot of energy coming in, say, no, let's move fast and let's like capitalize on this moment. So I'd love for you to just kind of speak to the landscape generally at this moment as you see the landscape of psychedelic medicine and what the opportunities are for folks who are interested in creating really ethical, sustainable, accessible business models.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time that we're in. Just a few years ago, it felt like it was us and a handful of other clinic owners and really practitioners stepping into building clinics that were working in such an amazingly collaborative space, supporting each other, sharing ideas, bouncing ideas off of each other, sharing resources, and, you know, ourselves, Polaris and Healing Realms, along with Temenos Center. So a little group of clinics in the Bay Area, and then also connecting with like Wholeness Center out in Colorado. So, but really there weren't that many of us, and we were all really trying to hold the work and in a good way, really committed to a solid preparation and integration and, you know, therapeutic alliance, all of that. And then, you know, just recently, these larger corporations have stepped onto the scene, MindBloom, Field Trip, and a few others. And alongside that, investors, corporate investors, VC funders have stepped in and started reaching out to many of us, asking, you know, to either invest or to buy us out and to take our business models and replicate them. And it's a challenging place to be for small clinics like ourselves who want to grow. And also, like I mentioned before, who have been really bootstrapping this from the beginning. And so it sounds very relieving to have a bunch of funding come pouring in and to support us in expanding our reach. But in doing that, you give up a lot of power and, you know, potentially even give up the, you know, control over the business altogether. And most people who are stepping into this work that I've spoken to, most clinicians starting these smaller clinics are not in it for profit and also not in it to sell. They're committed to their businesses and really want to see them grow and thrive. So we're kind of at this crossroads right now where, you know, a lot of us have said no and really maintained our, you know, our businesses and our passions. And in saying no to potential funders, it's giving something up. And meanwhile, there are others who are wanting to step into the field and, you know, may not have the financial resources to do so. So that's actually, you know, pretty much what our journey has been at Sage Health. And we came up to this place where we were talking to potential investors and realizing that ultimately the best way to support the field would be not through scaling Sage in and of itself, but through creating another organization that would support other clinics like us in their development and also in their ongoing operations. So during that time, really over the past year, I've been in contact and developing a relationship with Greg Kearns, who has been working in health systems for a long time and stepped into the psychedelic space about a year ago, really doing a survey of the field to get a sense of what it needed the most. And he came up with the Fourth Road vision, really, which has been all along an entity that would support the rollout of delivery systems in an ethical way. And so we joined forces a few months ago and have been thinking through how to best contribute to this process, how to best help independent clinics stay independent and practitioners do what they're here to do, focus on doing the healing work without needing to spend a lot of their time and energy learning how to do all these other like administrative and operational tasks. So what we're building is what's called a management services organization in part. That's one prong of it, which will offer basically a series of back-end services, everything from HR to payroll to administrative help to operational support to credentialing support, really, you know, kind of all of the things that practitioners don't really know about and don't want to deal with. We would be holding that for clinics. And hopefully, as we, you know, as we develop relationships with more and more clinics, creating the opportunity for them to benefit from economies of scale, which isn't possible as a small clinic, but which these larger corporations are getting to benefit from and it thus gives them a competitive advantage. So trying to give smaller clinics access to lower fees for some of these services. So that's one side of things. And then the other is a clinic incubator. So we're just getting started with a best practices study where we're starting off with Sage actually and doing a thorough kind of inventory of both Sages and our what's working for us, what's not, what are all of our different systems, you know, technology, admin, et cetera, et cetera. And then we're going to move on to speak to other clinics as well and develop a set of best practices, which we can then turn into templates, and we can also turn into a pretty intensive workshop. So we'll be able to support both new clinics and also, you know, current medical systems that are wanting to open up into psychedelics. So support them in their developments and really offer some solid handholding, because it's a process. So just supporting them along the way in building out what needs to be built, and then providing these back-end services for them to plug into.
You know, I was wondering who was going to do this. You know, like, ever since I read We Will Call It Paula, I was like, well, there needs to be like a coalition style organization, like something that, as you said, the economies of scale, like someone who can help compete in the marketplace for these individual clinicians. Because yeah, it's, I mean, people want to do the healing work that they do. They don't necessarily have the skill set of running a small business out the gate. You know, they don't necessarily have like the marketing chops to like get themselves out there. So I was actually wondering who was going to jump in. Do you know anyone other than y'all who are kind of working in this space, who are trying to help facilitate these independent practitioners?
Scott Shannon and the Wholeness Center in Colorado, it has been collaborating with MAPS to create a workshop to support clinics in starting to get a lay of the land of what it looks like to build a psychedelic clinic. And we're partnering with Scott to basically be the next step in that process, because what Scott's offering is introductory. People get a real sense of what it'll look like, but then they're kind of, you know, step out on their own after that. And so we want to pick up where he leaves off and offer a more intensive step-by-step process that walks alongside people throughout, and also ultimately these back-end services to plug into when they're ready. Other than that, you know, there may be others who are thinking something similar, but I haven't been in contact with them.
Well, it's such a wonderful model. It's such a great approach to this. And I appreciate that you're involved in it, because, you know, as this conversation evidences, and as I know from your work, that there are some key values that have been consistent through your work with Sage that I think could be woven into what Fourth Road is doing in a way that could be really effective in creating accessibility to these medicines. Because I see that as one of the key issues facing psychedelic medicine. And so to arm these independent clinicians, not just with the sort of know-how of running the clinic, but also with certain, you know, ethical frameworks and just philosophical perspectives to then be able to reach more people who might not otherwise get that treatment, I think that's huge.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's my real passion is, you know, I think of it as sort of both ethical guidelines and also best practices and, you know, kind of setting a standard of care for the field. And I'm still thinking through how exactly to weave that into Fourth Road and support the clinics that we engage with in delivering care in a way that really tends to the people that they're serving, that acknowledges the traditions from which we've developed these practices, that provides access to a wide range of people. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like, but it's a strong and, you know, kind of hope and intention of mine to make sure that that's a part of what Fourth Road has to offer.
And the standards of care that you refer to, are there any documents around what you've already learned, any kind of open source protocols or anything like that people listening might be able to look into?
You know, that's something that I really should put together. I don't know that there's, you know, I don't have anything that I've personally created and put out there at this point. A lot of the ways that MAPS practices, I'm super aligned with, and I've developed a lot of my ideas about how to hold this work from them. So you can always look at MAPS's manual for their MDMA for PTSD research. And I'm sure that others have written about this. So I just am not personally aware of it.
So we're getting close to the end of our time today. And a question that I ask on every podcast is that I always like to give my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the psychedelic therapist listening. So our audience are primarily psychedelic therapists or aspiring psychedelic therapists, although there are certainly enthusiasts. Hello, enthusiasts. Thank you for joining us. But if you could speak directly to this group of folks, words of encouragement, bits of advice, just anything that you'd like to say directly to those folks who are involved in this work or setting out on that path?
Let's see. I think there are a few things. One has to do with what you could call the silver bullet or the magic pill phenomenon that I know I came into this work believing. And it's promoted all over the media. It, you know, certainly in Michael Pollan's work and in other places as well, this idea that psychedelics are going to be a sort of panacea or magic cure. And while I do see psychedelics as incredibly effective in speeding up the treatment and, you know, offering a potential for healing when people haven't been able to find that elsewhere, it also, I think, is really just one tool in the tool belt. And psychedelic work is really most effective when it's paired with deep integration, with a very safe container, with a trusting relationship with a therapist, and really solid integration as well. I just saw my colleague Emily Willow post on her social media rubric that basically the integration of any psychedelic experience should be as long as the psychedelic experience itself, at least. And you know, just really to hold it in this more integrative way that incorporates the mind and the body, and that ties it into the day-to-day life in a way that's very intentional and honoring of these experiences that are profound, but that also are very different from how we exist in the day-to-day planes. So that's one piece. And then I guess the other piece is just to really stay connected to your ethics and to your passion, like what got you into this work and also, you know, why you want to help people. Like, I think that there's just so much happening in the psychedelic world right now that it's easy to get distracted. It's easy to take on too much. And I think it is also easy to get sort of pulled or, you know, drawn by the temptation to make a profit. And while there may be opportunities to do that, there may be many of them. Ultimately, I think what most of us are here for is to help people. And so, you know, as much as possible, I encourage folks to stay connected to that, because there are projects out there that are really starting to cut out what's essential in psychedelic medicine and call it psychedelic medicine still. Like MindBloom is one example of that. They are calling something their work ketamine-assisted therapy when there's not necessarily even a therapist in the room during the ketamine sessions. And so I'm just, you know, like the We Will Call It Paula story, I hope that people will really try to hold to what's essential in this work and not cut it out just to try to make a profit, because I think there is potential for people to get hurt in that process.
So where can people find out more? Obviously, Sage's website. Where can people connect more with you, with Sage? And is there any way for people to connect with the upcoming Fourth Road project now, or is that a little bit down the road?
So you can connect with Sage through the Sage website at sageinst.org is for Sage Institute, sageinst.org. And then sageintegrativehealth.org is the Sage Integrative Health website. In terms of Fourth Road, at this point, we definitely want to be connecting with you know, practitioners or clinics that are out there and that are interested in this kind of support. We do have a Fourth Road website, and so that's one way to go about it. If you Google Fourth Road Health, you'll find it, where it's very preliminary at this point, but that's one way to reach out. Yeah, and you're also welcome to email me at genesee@sageinst.org.
And we'll have all that in the show notes, so you can go there. Genesee, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And I love your passion for this work, and I really love the space you're holding. And prior to this conversation, I was not aware of Fourth Road, and it's been a space in the community that we've really needed. So I'm very excited that that's coming about. And I love the work that you're doing, and I appreciate you sharing with us today.
Awesome. Thank you, Eamon. It's been really great to talk with you. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of common interests there. So yeah, thanks for connecting.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.